This is November 25th, 2017, the day of Great Jukai, that is the receiving of the precept ceremony this afternoon, 5 o'clock, and possibly the most important day in the life of anyone who takes the ceremony, because Jukai, or the receiving the precepts, is considered, always has been, the most important ceremony in the life of a lay practitioner. That is, the only thing that is more important historically is ordination. So it's a big day. This ceremony has the potential of setting you so squarely on the path, the way, that can carry you for a long time to come, just to wholeheartedly take these precepts. The big difference between Great Jukai, this is a Great Jukai ceremony, which Great Jukai we've had every third year. But we were scheduled to have it last year, but that was the year of our 50th anniversary, which was all-consuming for the staff and others who planned and pulled it off. So we postponed last year's Great Jukai to this year. There are only two significant differences from regular Jukai, which we have every year, twice a year, actually, but the big once-a-year full Jukai ceremony. The two differences are that this ceremony in the Buddha Hall involves the burning of klesa papers, more on that later, and also the ceremony is preceded by a traverse through the tunnel of the six realms of unenlightened existence. Before we get on to that, just a very, very short review of the Teishos running up to today's ceremony. They were all in October, the 15th, the 22nd, 29th. On October 15th, the Teisho that I gave the title of Habit Energy, Our Lifelong Opponent, I talked and read just broadly about what we're up against is habit forces, and which is just another name for karma. We have certain tendencies based on our actions in the past, the long, long, long distant past, past lifetimes as well. We have certain tendencies, dispositions, propensities, habit forces that keep tripping us up, and that's all covered in the 10 cardinal precepts that are part of the ceremony this afternoon. That was the first of the three. The second one, I gave the title, The Three Poisons as Our Common Lot. This is just further articulating this habit energy, put it in terms of these greed, anger, and delusion, and all the aspects of that. And then the third Teisho, the last one before today, I gave the title Jukai and the Four Forces of Purification. That's a phrase that I don't know that I've ever used before in Teisho. I pulled it out of another reading, and just to review that, the four forces of purification. The first is called the foundation force, which is what we're doing this afternoon, taking refuge, the three refuges, and the other 13 precepts. The second is what's called the second of these forces of purification is the repentance, which we're also doing. We're doing that first in a ceremony this afternoon. Sometimes this is called intelligent regret. And then the third force of purification is resolving not to repeat it, repeat the things that cause us pain and cause other people pain. And the fourth we covered in that Teisho was makeup activity, things you can do to, as a, I guess penance would be a word, you don't see in Buddhist literature, but a way to feel like, and I mentioned the possibility of doing the repentance gata on one's own every day. So, two features of Great Jukai that we don't do every year. First of all, the burning, the ceremonial burning of klesa papers. First, a little bit about ritual. And, of course, that's what that's involved here in any ceremony. And I know there are people, I used to be one of them, who didn't see much point in ritual or ceremony. I know when I first got into Zen, I thought I didn't need any of that. You know, all you need is the Zazen. That's the heart of it all. It is the heart of it all in Zen practice. You know, we just recited the Hakuin chant, and there's a line in there: upholding the precepts, repentance, giving, the countless good deeds, the way of right living, all come from Zazen. All those things that Hakuin mentions is what we're going to be doing today. Why are we doing them if they all come from Zazen? Well, why have they been done? That is, taking the precepts formally and ceremonies and all. Why are they done? Why have they always been done by Buddhist masters and monks and nuns for hundreds and hundreds of years? Zen, not just anyone, but Zen masters who know that upholding the precepts, repentance, and giving the countless gifts away, and giving all come from Zazen. Why? Because they know that these secondary practices, which also include vows, taking vows, doing prostrations, chanting, all of which are involved this afternoon, that these support, they fortify one's practice of Zazen. So, please don't think you're above these ceremonies or rituals. That would put you above every Zen master in all Buddhist literature. There's a point to it. Of course, if you feel that you just can't get into it, well, that's regrettable, but then that's that. That's where you are. But who knows? You can enter into these things and have less than full-hearted involvement in it and still get something out of it. That phrase, fake it until you make it, that worked for me. I felt, okay, there's got to be a lot of wisdom behind these things. And even though I have some resistance to doing them, I'll do it. There are people far wiser than I who've been doing this, so I'll give it a try. And then it grows on you. If you can really put yourself into it and not go in with your mind clogged with critical thoughts. So this is the order of things. The idea is that we're ascending through the six realms of unenlightened existence. By the way, in Buddhist doctrine, there are said to be 10 realms of existence. The top four are Buddha realms, that is, enlightened realms. But the other six, the lower six, are the realms of unenlightened existence that we inhabit until, I suppose, full enlightenment. So the idea is that by going through this tunnel that has been set up here in this house and the back stairwell of this house, Seven Arnold Park, we start out in the hell realm and we make our way up. And this is something that until this year we've always done in the covered walkway outdoors. And this time, with the staff as small as it is, and we thought that we would try something new and have it indoors, especially because the cold, it's never warm on November, the last Saturday of November, the cold, I believe, tends to make people really kind of hustle through this display of the six realms. And it's a shame, because it can be quite evocative. It can even be inspiring. It can be galvanizing if we don't rush through this display. And it can be especially meaningful if we've done some zazen before going through these. Now, because of my concern that too many people rush through them, which is understandable, if you've got people behind you, I think many of us would tend to feel we don't want to hold anything up. But this year, I'd like to invite people to go through earlier in the afternoon. Earlier means any time after 4 o'clock. Again, the ceremony is at 5, and usually it's about 5 o'clock that we start inviting people to go through, or maybe 4:45, we start inviting people to go through the Six Realms Tunnel on their way out to the Buddha Hall. But this year, I would so much hate to have people rushing through that you could come to the center. You could, right away at 4 o'clock, go through the Six Realms Tunnel, take your time, assimilate these images. Images speak to something deeper in us than just text. Images and other sense experiences in these realms. Take your time, go through, you'll end up on the top floor here of Arnold Park. And then you can come down if it's still early, if it's, say, 4:10 or 4:20 or 4:30, or then you come down and sit in the Zendo. This is just a way to try to spread things out so that everyone isn't rushing through right before the ceremony. So we start in the basement of the Six Realms Tunnel, and our first... the first thing that happens is we encounter Yamaraja. Yamaraja is this mythical lord of the dead who, according to popular Buddhist teaching, is the guy or girl, could be, we run into upon death when we... And Yamaraja holds up not an account book, but a mirror. He holds up a mirror. And it is in there that we see reflected back to us our karma of this lifetime and previous lifetimes. So we actually go through that where... just past the changing rooms, we'll have Yamaraja there handing out these little klesa papers. Now, klesa, let's get clear on that. I dug out at my trusted Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion, and I'll just read what klesa... in Sanskrit, it's klesa, K-L-E-S-A... it's in Pali is klesha with an sh, but the sound is it's the same thing. And I'm reading here from this dictionary. Kleshas are subject to different analyses. In a certain Buddhist text, 10 of them are enumerated. Craving, hate, delusion, pride, false views, doubt, rigidity. That's a good one. You don't read that about that one very often, but many people would do well to bring that into their awareness. Rigidity, excitability, shamelessness, lack of conscience. So that's one way of thinking of them, those 10. But another way is that they're numberless, or the traditional number given to the numberless is 108. Those of you who've been here in recent years for New Year's Eve ceremonies will know that the big bell here outside the Zendo is tolled 108 times, and because 108 is supposed to be the number of defilements of human beings. It's just a certain formula, three poisons, time this, times the this, times the that, and they come to 108. The last thing in the world you have to know is how they got to 108, because it really represents just endless defilements. So we pick up there, we get from Yamaraja, this klesa paper. On the klesa paper are these three figures that you'll also see here this morning in the link. We posted a large representation of the traditional the wheel of life, or the wheel of samsara. And in this wheel, you see the three representations of the three poisons: greed, anger, and delusion. Greed is represented by a sneeze. Greed is represented by a rooster, cock. Greed, craving, desire. Anger is represented by the snake, or viper. And delusion is represented by a pig. And that's those three symbols are on the klesa paper that each of us will get as we go through. I go through this too. I love going through the Six Realms Tunnel. And then we carry that with us. We tuck it away in our little sweaty hand or somewhere else. And we move our way up the rear stairs here of the Six Realms. And we find ourselves up in the highest of the Six Realms, which is that of the devas, the gods or devas. And that brings us to first the realm of hell, which is the lowest in our stairwell. Now, hell. Oh, hell. Let's talk about hell. As so many of you know, I think historically in less technologically advanced, educated societies than ours, hells were taken literally. And there are all kinds of vivid, frightening depictions of hell that many of them I've seen in my pilgrimages and caves and other sites of China and India, Japan too. I think it's more... most of us resonate more to the psychological understandings of these six realms of unenlightened existence. So hell then would be any state of extreme pain. extreme. So extreme fear, extreme aggression, hellish anxiety, paranoia. These are hells. These are inner hells. So we burn with rage or hostility. We're tortured by anxiety. And this is just the states of psychological states, mental states. Does anyone not know that? Have you never in your life been burning with rage or tortured by anxiety, not even for a few minutes? But don't rule out that these states, starting with hell, is valid on a literal sense. Well, we know that if you have any exposure at all to news, you know that there are hellish realms, literally, in certain places of the world. What springs to mind is these places in Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, where to be young means to be pressured to join a gang, and if you're not, then you're either killed or tortured, or your family, your sisters, your brothers are tortured. That's hell. We know who doesn't have images of Syria, the absolute horrendous devastation of Syria and the starvation that continues now. This is hellish states, other places in the Middle East, and other places. We don't need to itemize different countries. And we have our own such states in our own country, of course. But aside from places that we can identify such as that, who's to say that there aren't literally hellish states as represented in Buddhist paintings? We have our own Christian heritage of hells that we know, the cartoons with the flames and Satan and the devil and the trident and all those things that are work their way into our minds over our lifetime. And it's you don't really need to believe that underground there are big caverns of flames and tortures. If you open your eyes and look around and see these other places, but maybe there are. That I don't mean underground; that would fly in the face of science. But realms where these things are happening. There's a 17th century Japanese Zen master Bunan. I've read comment on his writings in Teisho. He says something I think that's very, very important. Talks about emptiness, this fundamental shunyata, the teaching of emptiness or nothingness. He says, as for fundamental nothingness, when, for example, people sit and meditate, people think that control of the body and mind is the basis of, quote, not a single thing, but they are all wrong. And then he gives another quote, originally not a single thing exists, refers to the absolute non-existence of, quote, body and, quote, mind. This is just basic, essential experience of the Dharma, is from the very beginning, there's never been a single thing, no substantial thing, unchanging. Then he says, but when you reach here, when you reach this realm of nothingness, paradises and hells spoken of by the Buddha are certain. Hungry ghosts and animals certainly exist. Or to put it in a more simple way, emptiness is only form. Form is only emptiness, yes, but emptiness is only form. Anyway, hell, extreme pain. And we came up with something that I hope is not going to be off-putting to many people, which is we have a kind of a Trump leitmotif in this tunnel of the six realms, because really any one of us has or continues to experience one or more of these realms, mentally, emotionally. And so if it could be any of us, I think the most dramatic, spectacular form of these would be in our current president. Hell is actually not so obvious. We have six different photos of him, and they're pretty vivid. Hell, does he experience extreme pain? I'm not sure he does. If you have a way of externalizing pain, putting it on others as the cause, maybe he doesn't have experience much. Put it this way, if he's not aware of being in pain, in what sense is that painful? What sense is that hellish? Has to be some experience of the pain, of the suffering. The next realm up is hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, what is called pretas, P-R-E-T-A-S. And this, I think, is pretty easy to relate to. These are beings tormented by unfulfilled cravings or impossible satisfactions. So these are beings, and again, any of us can relate to this, beings who experience some kind of terrible emptiness within themselves. This is a different kind of emptiness than the shunyata. And we can't seem to fill it. And so there is this, we've lost our balance. We have this craving for certain experiences or things. They're depicted historically as ghoulish creatures with spindly, dried-up limbs and bloated bellies, tortured by insatiable hunger and thirst, without being able to satisfy them. The little that they are able to swallow, and these figures you can see in the link on that Wheel of Samsara print, the little they are able to swallow through the narrow gullet of their thin neck causes them unspeakable tortures, since food is indigestible for them and merely bloats up their bellies. And whatever they drink turns into fire, a drastic simile of the nature of passion craving. I'm reading here from Lama Govinda in his book Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. It says, whatever they drink turns into fire, a drastic simile of the nature of passionate craving, the sufferings of which cannot be stilled by giving into passion, since this would only increase its force, like a fire which you pour oil onto. So, if you don't take it literally, as like spirits, invisible, craving, hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits that are fluttering around us like that, then we can understand this as those of us who are tormented by any number of compulsions or cravings, addictions, alcohol, drugs, overeating, sex, video games, TV, internet, shopping, pornography, gambling. The third from the bottom is after hell and hungry ghosts, thirsty spirits, is animals. I was talking to someone recently, a real dog lover, who said, I think with some seriousness, why are they considered as an animals? Why are they considered in one of the lowest three realms? And I understand the sentiment, but dogs are animals. Animals, what characterizes animals is this bondage to instinctual drives and gratifications, bondage to reactivity, blind instinct, bondage to the body, to eat or be eaten, ultimately. Oh, yeah, backing up to the hungry ghosts, here to this, I think, is the, this and one other is the most obvious, so spectacularly on display in our president through his insatiable craving for attention and validation, which surely everyone must be aware of. But back to animals. Roshi Kaplow, in his autobiographical account in Zen, Merging of East and West, he talks about how before coming to practice, when he was just about to begin practice, he realized he was just had it with what he called the joyless pursuit of pleasure. Something animal-like about that. And then the next realm up is has different names and different texts. It's called the old word for it is asuras, A-S-U-R-A-S, asuras, which are sometimes called fighting demons or titans or anti-gods. And this we can understand psychologically, those who are incessantly driven to be winners, to be on top, you have to either on top or underneath, you got to be on top, you have to come out ahead. These are people who are driven by competition, by their need to have control and have power. And a benign form of this is all competitive sports, you could say. Sometimes this realm is put above the human realm, but I think it makes more sense to have it the third or the fourth one up before the human realm. And here there's the element of aggressive striving, this need to be high-achieving, and this relentless competitive force to approach and destroy the obstacles to their wants. And then the next one up, that is the second lowest of the six realms of underlying, is our humans. The distinguishing thing about humans is awareness of dissatisfaction. You could say that all beings suffer dissatisfaction. This is the first of the Four Noble Truths, dukkha, dissatisfaction. But as humans, we're saddled with the realization that anything we acquire, we can lose, including our life. That any person we partner with, we can lose. Our children, we'll lose. We will lose. Our life, our wealth, our if we live long enough, our strength, our physical well-being, our memory. But it is knowing this. This is the unique human thing. Govinda puts it this way: this is the realm of purposeful activity and higher aspirations, in which the freedom of decision plays an essential role. Here, the qualities of all realms of existence become conscious, and all their possibilities are equally within reach. And beyond them, the chance of ultimate liberation from the cycle of birth and death through insight into the true nature of existence. Again, it's the awareness of the of oneself as a discrete creature. And the search for the self. You could argue that everyone is searching for the self, not just people in practice. And that is the central predicament of human beings, is not knowing who we are, which causes us to feel inauthentic, alienated, anxious. And then the highest realm of unenlightened existence is that of the devas. We have a great photo of Trump and his, I don't know, second or third wife, and his one of his sons. Do take a minute to look at that. It is the quintessential deva existence. Devas being sometimes called the gods, heavenly beings, who, and we can understand that as those who have found themselves in a position of great fortune, good fortune, which could mean wealth, privilege. Attractiveness, sex appeal, beauty. Harmony, living in very harmonious circumstances, being famous. In the Wheel of Samsara that's posted in the link, this carefree life dedicated to aesthetic pleasures is indicated by dance and music. I'm reading again from Govinda. On account of this one-sided dedication to their own pleasures, they forget the true nature of life, the limitations of their existence, the sufferings of other beings, as well as their own transiency. They do not know that they live only in a state of temporary harmony, which comes to an end as soon as the causes which led them to this happy state are exhausted. They live, so to say, on the accumulated capital of past good deeds without adding any new value. They are gifted with beauty, longevity, and freedom from pain, but just this lack of suffering, of obstacles and exertion, deprives their existence of all creative impulses, all spiritual activity, and the urge for deeper knowledge. Thus, finally, they sink again into lower states of existence. I've always, long ago, reflected on the fact that you don't see great celebrities or very few who are drawn to Zen practice, because it takes some pain to do this practice. I mean, to lead us here, again, the dissatisfaction, the discontent. Now, this isn't to say that Hollywood celebrities and megastars and great celebrity athletes don't feel pain. Of course they do. But it's not enough that the privileges and wealth and adulation so apparently compensate for the pain enough that they don't they're not moved to do something fundamental, because it has to be fundamental. That's the nature of the six realms of the unenlightened existence, is that they're all temporary. We evolve and devolve. We ascend, we descend. That is the basic insecurity of sentient life. Change. I'm going to run through a very interesting take on the six realms. This is by Uchiyama Roshi in Japan. It appears in the book Opening the Hand of Thought. And this is, very briefly, this is how he sees the six realms for those who are practicing. And he particularly speaks of those monks, the ones in the temples and monasteries in Japan. He says, hell is where they hate sitting. This blew my mind the first time I heard it, that first of all, that most Zen temples in Japan don't do any sitting. They don't do any sitting. What does Zen mean? Zen means meditation. But that's how low Zen has sunk in Japan. Of course, there are big exceptions, terrific teachers and temples, but the vast majority don't sit. And those that do, he says, Uchiyama says, are doing so as a prerequisite to getting their teachings, priest certificate, so they can run a temple of their own. They're forced to sit to get there. You have to do, used to be two years of residential training, and it's been whittled down to 6 months because they're desperate to have people running temples. That has got to be some kind of hell. The next one up, Hungry Ghosts, is the craving of enlightenment, which means the thought of it, being slobbering over the thought of enlightenment, like the desperation of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits. Animals in the temples there, he says, are not just there, could be here too. They're like domesticated animals or pets. They're fed as long as they stay in the temple. This is the phrase you run across this in the koans of rice bags. The masters sometimes refer to these lazy monks who just want to get their three square meals a day and have a protected life as being rice bags. The asuras, fighting demons, are any of us who are competitive in our practice, who can be most severe and most ascetic in their sitting, who can stay up most in for late night sitting, yaza, during sesshin, who can sit in the most severe posture, full lotus or one other, who's most enlightened. Again, competition, comparing oneself. And then the human realms, and the realm, he says, is those who practice zazen just to improve their physical and mental health. They're practicing for something in return, in order to, as compared to a real, more of a Buddha perspective, is doing it for its own sake, not to get something. As long as you're trying to get something, then you don't realize from the very beginning all beings are Buddha. And then the highest realm of unenlightened existence, the devas, are heavenly beings. This suggests, can be understood as those who practice as hermits or recluses, who are trying to escape from worldly society, materialistic society, who are attached to silence and want to avoid the messy business of human interactions and stress. In the remaining few minutes, for those of you who don't know what these 16 precepts are, I'll just run through them very fast. The first of the 16 precepts are the three refuges: taking refuge in Buddha, that is our Buddha nature; taking refuge in Dharma, that is the law, the way, the Tao, the universal law of change and no self; and then the third, the Sangha, taking refuge in Sangha, that is us who practice. Those are the first three. The next three are just a broad three resolutions: to avoid evil, to do good, and to liberate all sentient beings. I have to skip over that really fast, because then those three are articulated in the 10 cardinal precepts. And those are: resolve not to kill, but to cherish all life. And each one of these, by the way, can be understood in three different ways, at least three, five or six different ways, but the most easily understood three ways are from a literal point of view, from a greater good point of view, and from the point of view of emptiness. The literal is just taking it literally. I resolve not to kill people or animals. But then beyond that, there's all kinds of other ways that we can kill things. We kill someone when we refuse to let them change, and we're so locked into our notions about them that they're just a concept. They're killed. There's no life to that if we are so set on seeing someone as unchanging. That's a big one, actually. A big one. And the same with all the others. Second is not to take what is not given, but respect the things of others. Third is not to misuse sexuality, but to be caring and responsible. Fourth is not to lie, but to speak the truth. The fifth is not to cause others to take alcohol or drugs, nor to do so oneself, but to keep the mind clear. Those five are the big five all over the world, every Buddhist country of those five. And then the other five are not to speak of the faults of others, not to praise oneself and disparage others. That's seven. The eighth is not to withhold spiritual and material aid. The ninth is not to indulge in anger. And the tenth is not to revile the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The ceremony will be more meaningful if you sit first, if you bathe, shower, and I hope that starting at 4 o'clock, some people will be making their way up through the six realms. It'll be 3 years before we set this up again, and then in the ceremony itself, there is this dramatic, I think it's pretty dramatic, burning of these klesa papers, in effect purifying our habit forces, so we can start afresh. All right, our time is over, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows. beings without number.
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.